Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today I have with me in the studio two writers who are touring together with new books, Cheston Knapp from Portland, who is the managing editor of Tin House Magazine, and Curtis White, who is from Port Townsend and the author of many books. I'll start with a bio about Curtis. Curtis White has been called the godfather of the modern literary avant-garde. The novel we'll discuss today, Lacking Character, marks his return to fiction after 15 years of publishing nonfiction books and essays as a culture critic. His life and work are deeply influenced by the counterculture of the 1960s, by the anti-war movement, and by the psychedelic art and music scene in San Francisco in the late 60s. To see many, many, many of his books, type Curtis White into your browser, and that is C-U-R-T-I-S White, and you will come up with many websites that have interviews with him, as well as reviews of his books and information about his writing. Cheston Knapp, I said, is the managing editor of Tin House Magazine, and with his wife and son, he lives a life of reluctant modesty in Portland, Oregon. Up, Up, Down, Down, the book we'll be talking about today, is a collection of personal essays, and it's Knapp's first book. You can visit him at his website, www.chestonknapp.com, and that's C-H-E-S-T-O-N-K-N-A-P-P.com. Welcome, Curtis and Cheston.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
I'm really glad you're here and really glad to be talking with you. So the first question I think a lot of people might have is, how did you two team up to be not only on this radio program together, but a book tour?
The briefest version of that is Tin House Magazine, David Foster Wallace, and tennis.
All right.
And IPAs. That's the... If I was going to telegraph how we met through the magazine that Cheston works for... We bonded over Tales of David Foster Wallace, tennis, and beer.
All right. Sounds like a wonderful title to an article.
No objections to that.
No? You want anything to add?
No, I think I was just really taken with Kurt's rangy intelligence. The writing world can be interestingly insular, and so it was fun to meet someone who felt like a kindred spirit in this project we've got going.
And when you first met, you weren't both in the Northwest.
No,
I was in Illinois.
Yeah, I was still in Portland.
Yeah, so here you are closer.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe do you both play tennis at this point?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe you can meet somewhere, some special tennis courts.
We've played here already.
Yeah.
Okay. Already today?
No.
In the past. Okay. Right. Well, Cheston knows that I have been struck by the brevity of his bio. It is all of three sentences, I think. And I want to know... a little bit about that. Why is your bio so short? Your essays are beautifully long and lengthy. There are seven of them in the book called Linked Essays, which we'll talk about. But why is your bio so short?
I think it comes down to that sense of, like, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything.
But this is about yourself.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
No, I don't quite believe in that notion that personal essayists are any more revelatory than a fiction writer. And so the persona I have in the essays is quite different than who I consider myself I am as a person walking around in the world. And so I didn't want to corrupt the sense of who that Cheston was.
Who that Cheston
in the book is. And I wanted, I guess, the work itself to say everything. And
well, I certainly believe that the Cheston in the book is a part of you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He is, but it's a cipher in a way. Just the way a first-person narrator would be in a piece of fiction. So
it's wonderfully shaped. The essays are wonderfully shaped around a current event in your life or in your neighborhood and the trigger that current event has for you to research more about your past and history and being. And then I think the literary part of you surfaces too, about shape and about what we can and cannot do as writers and how our writing life is different than our real life.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, I enjoyed that aspect of it so, so much. And of course, learning about wrestling, amateur wrestling, and a murder in your neighborhood, and you
UFOs.
Know, okay. Yes, UFOs,
skateboarding,
yes, all these things that could go on in my life, but don't exactly.
Right.
And I believe, I mean, they are the true things that are happening in your life and what you do with them. It proves again to me that when people are the most particular about events and perceptions, they are the most universal. So even though, of course, I haven't seen a UFO and don't really follow those stories too well, and certainly never went to amateur wrestling, thank God, have not experienced a murder in my neighborhood. All of the feelings that arise, all of the ways you look at things speak to me. And so I appreciated it very, very much.
Thank you. That's the goal. I think you put it really nicely there. The more particular that you can be, that's where you approach the universal. I think that's really true.
So with that, we'll move on to Curtis. It says, crazy character, characters. In your book, we have a marquis who is sent a message through the Queen of Spells. The message is brought by Percy, a subhuman being.
Puppet. Golem.
Who's been created by the Queen of Spells, who forgot about creating him.
Yeah, it was a brief over. He briefly overlooked his existence, yeah. But forgot him for a couple of months.
And yet, even though this is so fantastical, it isn't, because we live in this sort of crazy, overwhelming, overstimulating world with artificial intelligence and the rise of robots and all of that. But even so, there's something very universal. The Marquis plays video games all the time. Mm. Percy doesn't. He wants to go to community college. I've read that the setting of the book is set in a thinly veiled normal Illinois.
I tried as best I could to murder the particular in this book, so we're a good pair in that way.
Yeah. You are going to do a little bit of reading, and maybe we'll be able to start that way and then hear what we think of the murder of the particular.
Okay. So this puppet-like character named Percy has arrived in the town of N and met with the Marquis and somehow managed to get lost after meeting with the Marquis. And after a period of months, this character, the Queen of Spells, has to go looking for him. So she comes over from the Isle of Islay to central Illinois and is looking for Percy. When the Queen of Spells left the Marquis, it was clear to her that she would not get any help from him or anyone else in this strange place. She was on her own. She would have to provide her own resources, and fortunately, as we have seen, she was not lacking in them. The first thing she did in order to make her task manageable was to reduce the town to the size of a shoebox. In this fashion, she was able to lift it, turn it this way and that, get the lay of the land, so to speak, peek in a few windows, and generally satisfy herself that she knew the place. It should not surprise you to learn, knowing what you already know of this odd Middle Western town, that most of the townsfolk found their new tiny reality excessively liberal. Organizations were formed, protests planned, and the, quote, bigger party was formed, offering a list of candidates for city council and mayor. But many business and civic leaders found the new tiny reality interesting, as they themselves expressed it. A banner was strung across Main Street encouraging people to, quote, celebrate the new interesting. Inevitably, the local college students seized on this as an encouragement to party, and in short order, the celebration became one of their infamous beer riots. It could have been a lot worse. The students generated leaders as a swamp will spawn frogs, and a Facebook page for the party was created. Students from all over the state were invited for the biggest, baddest keg fest ever. One can only imagine the disappointment when the out-of-town revelers, having driven all the way from Carbondale and Charleston and Macomb, discovered that N was only a lively shoebox. After some consideration, the out-of-town revelers concluded, "Whatever, man," and drank their beer by the side of the road, amusing themselves, and it was funny, by flattening the little town and using it as a frisbee. Fortunately, by the second day, the students had emptied all the kegs, returned home, and collapsed back into their sodden apartments, after which the more balanced opinion of the adults came to the fore. At a memorable meeting of the town council, residents complained that the new town felt cramped. The mayor said that he understood their complaint, but they should acknowledge that there were very positive payoffs for the new downsized municipality, and folks needed to take them into consideration. For example, he offered, property taxes would essentially disappear since the largest estate in town now could be covered by a postage stamp, and most city services could be eliminated since they could now cut the grass at the park with Granny Osage's pinking shears, and the thimbleful of garbage they generate each week could simply be dumped outside of their town box into the old big world, where it would be no larger than an average sparrow poop. I don't need to tell you how persuasive these ideas were for these simple people. They were all for it. Sadly, all of these arguments became moot when the city's liability lawyer observed that many people had been taken to the emergency ward at local hospitals because of various bumps and bruises suffered as the queen turned her toy town this way and that, not to mention the calamities they all suffered while being thrown around like a frisbee. He said that if the town in any way recognized the new interesting as settled law, the town would face multiple liability suits for damages to person and property that would drive it into bankruptcy. A disappointed O filled the room, and one thin graybeard angrily complained that federal regulators should keep their hands off our freedom to be as tiny as we want. This mooting was made even moodier because the Queen of Spells decided that she'd learned what she needed to know about the place, and having no intention of shrinking herself, she returned N to its accustomed scale and to its time-honored grievances with reality.
Thank you. I have much to say about detail, but we'll wait until we've heard an excerpt from Justin.
I feel like this is not even the old interesting, what I'm about to read. So this is from this essay called Learning Curves, sort of about how I became a writer. I didn't know I would ever want to be a writer when at 17 I started to keep a journal. And if those early entries reveal anything, it is the near crystalline insanity of that dream. They take as their subjects things like how much I'd partied at Beach Week and how certain friends... That they were not really my friends deserves mention. I recall setting out to convince my future self that they, who numbered among the popular kids, had been my friends. Such was the level of self-deception I was operating on. Had cried as they headed off to college. In one entry, I announced that I'm a cynic and a misanthrope, and then, mere entries later, I declare, without a hint of irony or self-awareness, that I'm a born people person. Then there are the girls, my nauseating desire for, my persistent lack of success with, their names light as sundresses. Allison, Katie, Lindsay, Ginny, Christine, Katie, Katie. Girls are so dumb, I lament. I just want someone to hold hands with, I emote. But sometime during my freshman year of college, the record shows, I started to transcribe poems and quotes from whatever I was reading. I was reading. There's some Dickinson and Eliot and Frost, Vonnegut and Kafka. I practiced what only by the loosest definitions qualifies as explication. Observe my inchoate insight. I finished Kafka's The Metamorphosis. It was an interesting short story that I thought contained many underlying meanings and themes. It wasn't long before I was writing descriptions, full of dashes, of my solitary walks through snowy Virginia woods, peppered with phrases in Latin, a language I'd never studied. I composed metered lines about the stars and the moon that used the word sublunary as though I'd bought it at cost. Reading back through these entries now gives me a sensation something like when you put your hand up against another person's and massage the twinned middle fingers, a charge of the familiar and the utterly mysterious. This is and cannot be me.
Bravo.
Thanks. Thank you.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today, Sheila is speaking with both novelist and culture critic Curtis White about his newest novel and Cheston Knapp about his collection of linked essays during a Port Townsend stop on their joint book tour.
I think what I would say you have in common as writers, even though it's very divergent what you're doing, is personality. There's so much personality in each of your writing. So, hey, back to murdering the specifics.
Particular, sorry.
Are they different than specifics?
Close. All right. Family resemblance.
Okay. Facebook, political organizations, beer, tiny shoebox. I am getting a very particular universe here, and I'm a little sorry they can go back to their normal size in normal Illinois.
That's all right, because more things happen to
them. All right. But anyway, I think that good writing really has personality, and good writing really draws the reader in with what I call specifics, but their cousin particulars. So I just don't think it's actually really possible to murder them.
I'd like to.
Okay, well, that's different. I mean, yeah, we don't get to do what we'd like to always, let alone as authors. That brings me to something that you say, Justin, in one of your essays, that after a very sad occurrence where your wife suffered a miscarriage, you realized that you should say it in your language, what you could do as a writer and what you can't do as a narrator of your life.
What did I say? It's probably much more intelligent than I'll drum up here, but I do think this is an interesting idea. I think that writing of the sort that I think Kurt and I aspire to both embraces and outpaces the particulars of one's life or situation so that they're not entirely done away with, but they're transformed into something maybe slightly recognizable. There's some way that it distances itself from the banality of just a thing as it is in the world, right? This is something I think we end up talking a lot about, the transformative power of art. And
the Russian critic Shlavsky calls it estrangement. In other words, the particulars of a recognizable world may be there, but they've been estranged in some ways. And for Shlavsky and for us, I think that process of estrangement of the real or the estrangement of the particular is a kind of liberating gesture. In other words, literature for us is something that is supposed to free us from a kind of over-prescribed or quotidian or an oppressive even perspective on reality.
Right. It's exhilarating. And the way poet teachers of mine, what they have taught me, which is at least related to what you're saying, is that they would say often, the words are smarter than I am. Hmm. That the words that came out in their poems came through them, and they didn't take ownership in a certain way, and they found wisdom that they wouldn't have thought they had. So what you said was there were many things you could do in your writing, but one thing you could not do is be the author of your life. You use the word expecting, that you and your wife had been expecting, the friends of yours were expecting. What a delightful word that was, as if your life can go according to plan. And then you realize it can't.
Right.
And I just love that opening to the fact that we can only do so much as writers, but we can, as you're saying now, lift ourselves
right
from what's going on in our lives to something, what would we call it? Bigger? Beyond? More intelligent?
I would hope it's bigger, just because of that, what Kurt mentioned, feeling boxed in by something. I'm pretty dissatisfied with the way the world is, you know, and it would be a shame if that were the given. I think that the freedom we have to be the narrators of our situations or whatever world we want to live in, we're able to sort of participate in that creation. Yeah.
And Kurt, that's how we make a new world, really.
Yeah. In some ways, there are political thinkers who do that and want to enact change in this world. And I think they're aspiring to a kind of artistic living that we hope to do in our just daily practice of it.
Like the shoebox people in your excerpt with regular sized people drinking beer on the curbside. Mm-hmm. It's so absurd, but it's so true.
There are a lot of sort of specifics in there that you recognize. You say, well, yeah, college towns, beer parties, kegers, whatever. But it's actually a very Rabelaisian thing that I do. There's this chapter in Francois Rabelais' Gargantua and Pantagruel where the chapter is called The City in Gargantua's Mouth. That section that I read is sort of after Rabelais. And all of my little chapters in here, or many of them, are after another writer.
You have that in print
right
there.
Yeah. And so I say after Rabelais, you know, sort of imagining that people might remember a passage in Rabelais like that, although there's no shortage of them, where the sort of dimensions, big and small, stop making their usual kind of sense. And you can have a city council meeting in something that's the size of a shoebox.
And really, when you think about the whole universe, we are really the size of a shoebox.
Yeah. It's to me, I mean, it's the kind of literature that was really liberating for me as a writer when I said, you can do that. Rabelais, wow, in the 16th century, he could do that. That's amazing. People often think that what I do is in some way unconventional or newfangled or radical or cutting edge or avant-garde. I don't think it's really true, because what I'm doing is appealing back to a kind of literature that has existed for literally thousands of years. It's called Menippean satire. Hmm. Rabelais was writing a Menippean satire, going back to Petronius and the Satyricon and the great Roman satirists, where the focus of the satire is on how people look at things, not satirizing a particular person, but perspectives, the way people look at the world. And so what that satire attempts to do is to loosen the hold of those customary perspectives on us. And that's a large part, I think, of what I tried to do here, because this book, I think, is a satire, basically. Okay. It's a satire in the form of a novel using parody and many, many voices.
One thing you've done is insert the narrator into the book at some point as a character.
Right. I had a lot of fun with that. The narrator starts as an omniscient narrator, and then he becomes an unreliable narrator when he inserts himself in the story. At a certain point, he becomes, maybe he's not the narrator at all. Maybe he's another creation of the queen. And then after that, his character just begins to dissolve as people start pointing out to him that his face is changing and that it's all composed of cartoon faces like Wimpy from the old Popeye cartoons. And eventually, his character and the character of all the characters in the book just simply dissolves and falls on the ground. So, yeah, it's fun to feel free to do that sort of thing. And I suppose as a writer, that's part of my message to other writers and readers is it's fun, it's funny, and it's sort of politically, socially liberating to feel free to do those kinds of things.
I just want to add that the title of your book is Lacking Character, and by the end of the book...
Everybody lacks character.
I think that's something I just want to add this. Like, we just got like a two-part answer to a question where Kurt layered on things like Manipian satire and Rabelais and all this. But really, this is a way of having fun and a tradition of having fun. That spirit comes across and just you hear it in the excerpt. You feel it from throughout the book of just someone at play in a very deep and real way. So having to label it anything is problematic, you know, to say it's a satire, it's a novel, it's whatever. That's already to start to put it into that sort of suffocating box that we were talking about.
And that's how we live now in literature.
Yeah. Wait, is it a memoir? Did it really happen to you?
Auto-asphyxiation.
Yeah, right. auto-asphyxiation.
Is that an in-joke?
No, they call that the auto-fiction is that practice of putting oneself in the narrative.
It's auto-asphyxiation.
No, it's just auto-fiction.
Oh, but you did say asphyxiation.
Yeah. Asphyxiation. Well, he said I was strangling myself, or someone was strangling someone. I forget what he said.
Well, it's just hard. I mean, you work for a magazine and you know this in publishing. The first question you're asked is, what shelf does your book belong on? Like you have to, as an author, you're supposed to think about what niche it occupies. And you can't just say, I don't know. You can't just say many. You can't just say the front window. It's constricting from the get-go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The critic John Berger, who was also a fiction writer, had that great line about this where he just said, it's all storytelling. His essays, these like, you know, ways of seeing this and that. It's all storytelling. I sort of feel like if we could get away with that, poems, it's all a form of trying to enact that impossible intimacy between someone you haven't met. So
I'm envisioning a new bookstore.
Yeah, decentralized.
Yeah, that would just have books and just go and discover. You know that feeling when, I'm sure it's happened to you, you're in a bookstore and a book that you had no idea about just seems to fall in your hands?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be fun if a whole store was like that?
Mm.
What else would you like to tell us about writing and your writing?
I think writing itself, especially in a sort of straight-jacketed times psychically, the more you can play around with words and the more you can define your world for yourself, the better. It's funny because we do write such different things. People often think about essays as just you take stuff from your life and you're not making up stuff, you know, you're not making the world up as you go. And that's never really rung true to me. It feels as creative or imaginative, the sort of goal in writing essays as writing fiction. I don't know, Kurt, you've done both. How does
Yeah, I mean, each book to me, I try to reinvent the whole thing. I really try not to write the same book twice, not only in terms of the materials and but in terms of the way it's written,
right.
You know, the way it's structured. I'm a very architectural writer, so each book I want to have a different kind of architecture, different kinds of ways of thinking about how to organize the book, I suppose is the simplest way of putting it.
The most wise advice I've come across with writing is like six words by this critic named Guy Davenport, the Kentucky writer. And he had this book that was named after an essay he wrote, which I don't like as much as the title. And it's Every Force Evolves a Form. That's about the best that it gets for me. We gussy up a lot of like received wisdom about writing, and I feel like it just pretty much comes down to that every force evolves a form, those five words.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about Cheston's book for me was over the years, I had seen these essays individually, but then when I saw them together, I realized that not only that each essay individually was brilliantly good, but that he had created a real form for these essays, that there was a not a structure per se, but a kind of a movement, a very powerful movement, sort of like natural force. The stories gradually get more complex and longer. And they also get more sort of emotionally and morally powerful as we get towards the end. So it's an amazing book to read. It's not just a collection of essays. It's a real kind of drama.
Mm-hmm. I had that experience. Know? Especially, you have an epigraph quote at the mm-hmm. beginning. Here I am, a stinking adult. Yeah. Is that Ashbery?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, wow, what a way to start a book. I mean, like, really, a stinking adult. And then by the end, the narrator, who is different than you, is an adult, has gone through memories of childhood, memories of untangling family history, memories of events that happened in college, and then really having to grapple with the stink of adulthood.
Right.
I felt that so much. And the word linked comes up sometimes in descriptions of your book, but it's more than linked. It's what you're talking about, Kurtz, that it's a body, it's a form, it's a movement.
Yeah, and that was the fun part of taking these seven essays and trying to find a way to make them all resonate with one another and vibrate against one another.
The other thing that occurs to me that our books have in common is that they're both about identity.
Yeah.
His book is a much more personal look at the question of identity, but the things that he does with that in the course of the book, the way in which his sense of identity, even for this sort of fictionalized version of himself, becomes really moving and powerful. My book is a more abstract, I think, look at the problem of identity because all of these characters are desperately trying to fill themselves.
Right.
Desperately trying to fill themselves one way or another so that they become real.
Mm-hmm. Of course,
I suppose for a book that I insist is my ode to joy, as I've said to just about everybody, anybody who will listen, it doesn't have a very happy ending because all of these characters fail in their quest to fill themselves in one way or another, whether it's with things or food or sex or the delusions of being a marquis or whatever. Even though they fail at all those things, I think it's not an unhappy ending because there's a sense in which that's what we have to accept. As any good Buddhist would say, you know, this whole notion of the ego or of character is an empty notion. And what's really inside is emptiness. And what we have to learn how to do is to think emptiness in a positive way.
I agree with you. I also think that by looking as the viewer, the reader, into this situation, we learn a lot. Yeah. So our identity changes mm-hmm. because we've experienced what happens to all these characters. Yeah. So I think that our time is up. It's been so delightful to talk literature and to talk about how it happens for you in your own writing and for me to participate as reader of some very wonderful writing. So thank you again very much.
Yeah, thank you. It was fun.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.